Speaking with West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Let's begin with student loans. There's been a couple different bills passed in the House. The Senate last week did not take up legislation. Is there going to be something soon on this?
Boy, I sure hope so. You know, I mean, did we not know a year ago that the student loan rate was going to double on July 1st? So why we couldn't get to an agreement is almost beyond us. The president included a proposal in his budget that he submitted back in April. We in the House voted for a bill that was very similar to his proposal, and that is that, yeah, the rate's going to go up a little bit because we're going to use the government's borrowing authority, you know, the cost of borrowing at the government rate. So it'll go a little bit above 3.4%, which was the old rate. But it certainly wasn't going to double to 6.8%. But the failure to act saw the student loans double to 6.8%. So the House prevented that by imposing new legislation that really has a more variable rate. The Senate, I'm told this last week now, has come to an agreement that is very, when I say an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats there, that is very close to the House proposal. And if they're able to pass that this week, like I think they can, based on what's been described, my sense is that instead of going to conference and ironing out the minor differences between the two, coming back for a vote in both bodies, that the House would simply accept the Senate version and make it retroactive so that the folks who did file for student loans really beginning July 1st won't have to pay 6.8%, but in essence will pay the cost of borrowing plus a very small add-on to that in terms of servicing the loan, but it'll be nowhere close to 6.8%, and we'll get it done. And I think, at least the House bill, I think that we're going to make it permanent so that we don't have to go through this up and down like we certainly did not only this year, but last year and the year before that, too.
When you say make it permanent, meaning it would stay at that rate, or would there be a slight indexing?
It'll be the cost of government borrowing. So in essence, the T-bill rate plus a small add-on to that. And there'll be variable, not necessarily fixed. There'll be a cap so that it won't exceed a certain number. And I don't know what I think the House and the Senate cap are slightly different. So again, if they can come to an agreement and get something done. But it's tragic that we've had to wait, you know, I mean, for a year. We've known that the rates were going to double on July 1st. Well, that's now a couple weeks ago. There's no reason to think that we can't get our act together. And, you know, the Senate following really along what the House has done is a very good signal, and hopefully it gets done before the end of the week as Congress comes back Monday and Tuesday this week.
If it came to it, could you live with what Senator Stabenow proposed, the freezing of the student loan rates?
Well, that's probably not going to happen. You're probably not going to see a freeze at 3.4% for 1 year. And why is that? Because then next year, an election year, you'll do the same thing. So why not fix this for good? And it's my understanding that the Senate has backed off the one-year freeze because that, again, would just extend it until next year. You'll go through the same debate again. So let's fix it. Let's do it right. And again, the president in his own budget sort of set the parameters of the framework for what I think will be an acceptable agreement between the House and the Senate, certainly Republicans and Democrats, and I think the president will sign it.
All right, let's deal with another issue which has shown some divisions in Congress, and that's immigration reform. The Senate has passed a bill, and the House so far has not said it's going to take it up, going to work on its own version. What are you going to look for in any sort of immigration reform?
Well, a couple of things, and I've met certainly with local leaders here in Michigan for the last number of months. We've gotten a lot of mail and emails on this. It's an issue that's not going away, nor should it, because today's system, the current system, is broken big time. I spoke to a number of growers in the last couple of days, and, you know, as the blueberries now are coming up into harvest season and peaches, and we know apples in the fall, many of our growers, if not all, I can't say all because I haven't spoken to them all, but there's not a grower out there that needs a workforce that hasn't said, Fred, we're in trouble. Some of our farms are hundreds of workers short now as the real season is picking season is beginning. And as we all know, we have probably 11 million undocumented workers in the United States. There are a few people that would like them all to go back, but I think most folks agree that that is not going to happen. We need to fix the system, not only for them, but also our employers and for all of the things that we've done. Now, the Senate took about a month, and they passed a very comprehensive bill. Lots of different things in there. It was bipartisan, passed, I want to say, 2-1. And the Senate may be a little bit better than that, 68 votes.
So why can't that get through the House?
The House, the Speaker and others have made the point that, yes, we are going to deal with immigration reform. What we're likely to do, and we've been behind, this is one of the few issues where the House has actually been behind the Senate. There have been a number of hearings. There's really two committees of prime jurisdiction. One is the Judiciary Committee. The other one is Homeland Security. We have members from Michigan on both those two committees. I'm not, but we have Candace Miller's on Homeland Security, where she's the subcommittee chair. And we've got John Conyers, of course, who's a ranking member, senior Democrat. He'd be chairman if the Democrats were in charge of the House. What I think you're likely to see in the House is we're going to take up a number of bills, probably 4 or 5, looking at different things. So, as an example, border security. Everyone acknowledges that they want a border security provision in this bill. Well, it just happens that Candace Miller, again from Michigan, brought a border security bill up before the Homeland Security Committee, and it was approved by a unanimous vote. Every Republican, every Democrat voted for that. My sense is that that bill will be offered as a separate bill on the House floor probably maybe in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That'll be one element of immigration reform. You look at E-Verify, which is a system that requires employers to check on every worker applicant, supposed to be pretty instant check. Don't know whether it works. We'll see how that. I haven't seen how that legislation is written yet. We're going to look at probably an interior bill to look at, you know, the folks that are within the United States and what's going on. You know, part of the border security plan, I believe that Candace Miller has, would require an entry and exit provision so that when people come in and they're not U.S. citizens, we'll know when they leave, and there'll be some type of tracking authority or some provisions on that. What I'm saying is that in all likelihood, the House will consider probably 4 or 5 different aspects of what the Senate's done. As most legislation, it's usually always different between the House and the Senate. My guess is that taking these elements up will take us into September. And probably whatever passes in the House will then go to conference where the differences can be ironed out. Probably about the end of September, beginning of October is probably the time frame where they'll iron out the differences between the two and the bill will come back. So we'll see what happens. But I think, I know that the Speaker, we had a closed Republican conference last week. Every one of our leaders, from the majority leader to the Speaker to the Republican whip, all reiterated that the current system is broken. Doing nothing is not where we need to be. We need to work on a bill that is, in essence, bipartisan, that really offers some protections. No one in the House is talking amnesty. Frankly, neither is the Senate. No one jumps ahead of somebody else that's already in line to become a citizen. But it's a very complex process, and we hope to see some resolve really by mid to late fall.
Is it accurate that John Boehner plans to stick to this idea that a majority of House Republicans are going to have to support a bill before it moves out?
Yeah, well, he's made the point. So we have 234 Republicans. And unlike the farm bill last week, where we needed, you know, to control the House is 218 votes out of, remember, we're a body of 435. So 218 wins. So last week we needed 218 to get a farm bill passed, in essence, among the Republicans, 218 of the 234 Republicans. So the Speaker has made the point that we'll need a majority of the Republicans, which is 117. You'd like to think that as a major initiative like this, immigration reform, something that's been broken for years and years and years. I got to say, I think it was 1986 that last, it was before I was in the Congress, passed in the House. So he's going to need 117 Republicans.
But for something that can be so complex and so difficult to pass, do you include idea of the majority of the majority, or can get something through, do you live with it?
You know, Speaker Pelosi, she had pretty much the same with almost everything that they did.
Dennis Hastert was famous for it.
Yeah, and Pelosi came after Hastert. So, you know, the speakers made the point that we need to come together as a family. They didn't say those words, but we need to be together. And if you, let's say you get, let's use an example. Let's say you get 120. Well, that means you're going to have to get a number of Democrats too. So at the end of the day, it is very likely to be a bipartisan bill versus a purely partisan one. And on an issue that's this important, don't you really want a bipartisan piece of legislation? Especially with a program that we know is so broken and needs to be fixed. And, this is the time now to do it. The strong vote in the Senate puts added pressure on the House to get things done. And I'm one that does believe that we can begin to see some of these elements pass in the House individually, which then collectively would go to conference with the Senate to iron out the differences.
David Brooks wrote in the New York Times last week that he believes the House should pass the Senate bill, and he made the argument that it fulfills a lot of what conservatives want, including that it's projected to reduce the deficit, it's pro-growth, it spends a lot of money to protect the border, and he says the problems with the Senate bill are small compared with the benefits. Do you see some problems with the Senate bill that you would have trouble living with if it came on the House floor?
No, I'm not. I don't pretend to be a student of the Senate bill because I'm not in the Senate. I followed the debate a little bit, but I don't know the I's and T's. I know that it had a very strong vote. But, the legislative process is one. I do think that we're going to get to the finish line on a responsible bill that can pass in both the House and the Senate. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, scored what is the Senate bill cost? And they said that, in fact, it will reduce the deficit by nearly $200 billion over a 10-year span. I think most people would say that's a good thing. More people working, paying taxes, being here legitimately. The Senate has a lot of strengths, background checks. Again, no one goes ahead of the line for people that are already in line to become citizens. And it's a remarkable stretch that they were able to get this thing done on a bipartisan vote. And, at the end of the day, I think that'll continue, and not only in the House, but also in the final report that probably gets done early-ish October.
You recently gave a speech in which you stated your support for hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. What regulations do you think the United States government should have on that practice of extracting natural gas?
Well, the states have done a pretty good job already here in Michigan and other states around the country. Hydraulic fracking is one of those tools that has been used to extract oil and gas from, thousands and sometimes thousands of feet below the surface of the earth. Literally, this has been done more than a million times in the last 50 or 60 years. Much of the chemicals and the water that is used, in fact, is recycled. It's recaptured for that. And one of the reasons why many of us believe that, in fact, the United States is part of North America, we can be energy self-sufficient, energy independent. By 2020, we've discovered lots of reserves, billions of barrels, not only in oil but also gas. There has not been a single case, the EPA has studied this, single case of groundwater contamination, despite literally a million fracking operations that have been done throughout the rest of the country. There are safeguards that are in place. That pipe, when it goes down, it goes way below the groundwater table. Sometimes those pipes then go laterally 2 or 3 miles from where that first pipe comes down. Because of the new technology, the footprint is so much smaller than what you had to do before with individual mine shafts coming, all these different places. You can do multiple lateral operations. Fracking usually is about 50 feet or so on either side from that fracking tube. What it does, it has a burst of energy that then breaks up the shale or the rock wherever that oil and gas is trapped. And sometimes oil or gas then will flow for as long as 15, 20 years back up. And we've seen in the Bakken reserves in North Dakota and Montana and other places around the country, literally hundreds of thousands of barrels that are being successfully drilled because of this, the new advances in hydraulic fracking, which is, you know, it's an old science that we've been using for decades.
Michigan Democrats in the state House, they've proposed bills that would, among other things, require disclosure of the chemicals used for fracking. Should that be done at the federal level?
Well, the states have actually done that. Many in the industry support that. I don't know that we need a federal law based on, you know, a track record where, again, you don't have any breaks at all. But it's, you know, it's something we'll see. We have a new Secretary of Energy. We're going to have a new, I suspect that we're going to have a new administrator of the EPA in the next couple weeks. Gina McCarthy is likely to be confirmed, I think, before the August break. So I'm sure that these discussions will be ongoing, and we'll see where it takes us. But we've been successful in really reaching these, what was before really trapped out of the way oil and gas reserves because of the advances that we've made, and we'll see where it takes us.
Should we be concerned about going that far down? Because wasn't that one of the big problems with the BP oil spill in the Gulf? They were going so far down that it was tough to get it contained once it started, if there's ever a problem.
Well, this is – you're not going to have – we haven't had that problem in the United States. And, again, often these pipes going down are 1,000 feet well below the established groundwater into the – through coal reserves into the trapped, often shale, whatever. The fracking that's used, there's a number of different chemicals that are used. It's almost like a jelly that goes out so that the sand that's used, keeps those cracks open so that the oil and gas can flow back. And rather than have the sand come back up and jam the equipment, the sand stays there because they're able to change it from a liquid to a gel and then back to a liquid so that the sand stays in place. So it's, and there's often double or triple capsuled going down in terms of the pipes and what's going to and capped with cement. So it really has prevented any type of leakage into the groundwater.
National Journal did a profile on you end of May. The title was "A Polarized Congress Tests Fred Upton's Instincts." Has Congress changed that much in the 20-plus years you've been there? And has that eventually worked its way down to affecting the way you do your job?
Well, you know, an old story for me. When I was first elected, the Republicans had not been in majority for, in essence, my lifetime. You know, a little couple months early when I was like 5 months old, but other than that, for my lifetime, we had not been in the majority, and we took the majority in 1994. I was born in 1953, so it was a long time. So today, so I remember when I was first elected, a woman in our leadership, Lynn Martin, then the chairman of the Republican Conference, addressed the freshman Republicans and said, "Man, if you think you have a good idea, two things are going to happen. It'll either be defeated or it'll get stolen. You're not going to have a big effect here." And I have gone out of my way on literally every piece of legislation that I've supported, authored, tried to promote through our committee now as chairman to be bipartisan. I can remember reaching out, a story if you got time for it, is I helped with the disabled. We were able to get a tax credit for small businesses that needed to make structural changes for their buildings. I knew that they didn't want to discriminate against someone in a wheelchair or walker, but they didn't have the resources. And so I finally, it took me a little while, but I found actually the congressman for my mother-in-law, then alive in Baltimore, Kwaisi Mfume. He's actually been here to campus since then. He later became the head of the NAACP. Very good friend. I might be the only person that could say his name correctly, though, especially when you see how it's spelled. But Kwaisi, in a moment of jest, grabbed my lapel after this became law and said, Fred, what have you done to my reputation? I'm a leading member of the, with a big smile, leading member of the Black Caucus, and I'm a, you know, diehard liberal, lefty, you know. Some people call me communist. I'm putting words in his mouth now. But you have, I'm now being hailed by the Chamber of Commerce and the NFIB and all these things for the legislature. You have sullied my reputation. What have you done?
But what did, what did he do to your reputation?
Yeah, well, but you know, we got it done. And it was actually hailed back then, this is the early 90s, as one of the most significant pieces of legislation helping small business. And so I can say that for me, and I don't know, as I look at our record, as for me as chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the last Congress, we had 1,000 bills referred to our committee. We passed 88 bills on the House floor. Almost all but four or five, had Democrat support, and 40 of them got signed into law, one of them helping here with Pfizer and Stryker in terms of expediting the food and drug approvals for pharmaceuticals and medical devices. This week, I had a big meeting this morning with a number of our physicians, and I guess I should say next week, we're gonna fix the what we hope we'll have the votes to do the doc fix. This impacts every senior on Medicare, so anyone over 65 years old, and fixes the reimbursement for physicians as it relates to their services that they provide to seniors. It's been a long time coming. I mean, this is a the doc fix is year after year. It's been a Band-Aid. It's, you know, the physicians have been threatened with a 25 or 30% reduction, real cut in the reimbursement for the services they provide, whether it be a new knee or, you know, fixing an elbow or, you know, whatever it might be for any of our seniors. It's been a Band-Aid year to year, real troublesome. So not only for folks trying to get services, and there are some physicians now that just say, oh, you're on Medicare, sorry, we don't do that anymore. So we really looked at the physician community, had a number of different hearings. I'm hoping, that's wood, right? Not for Micah here. I'm hoping that we can pass this on a very strong bipartisan vote, maybe unanimous in subcommittee next week and the full committee the following week. But it's, you know, all the issues that we've done, even this year, we've passed a number of bills with good Democratic support. I'm proud of that record. And going back to your question, oh, it is, look, we have divided government. We have the Senate at 55-45 Democrat. In the House, Speaker Pelosi, when she was Speaker, she enjoyed an 86-vote margin. Ours in the House under Boehner is very small. It's 234 to 231. And we have about another 15 or 20 Republicans that insist on voting no on just about everything. So it's tough to really get stuff done, but we've done our very best, and I will continue to do so, not only as my role as chairman, but, you know, just as, and you've heard me say this around, you know, certainly our district over the years, people don't really care if you have an R or a D next to your name, Republican or Democrat. They just want the job done. And that's what I've tried to do, not only as chairman, but obviously representing the 700,000 folks that I do in Southwest Michigan.
Okay. I have not found a definitive answer to this question, so I will ask you. Have you
I was going to give you an answer before you asked the question. No, I'm kidding. All right.
Do you have, is there any possibility you will be running for U.S. Senate next year?
Well, I guess any possibility, you know, maybe light, you know, probably not. We said early on that, you know, for me, first of all, my wife is very happy with Fred Upton most of the time. but, you know, for us, I mean, let's just face it. It's about a $20 million campaign to be successful next year. We have an open Senate race. If Carl Levin had run again, he would have won in, you know, in a walk. That's for sure. But for the maybe the four leading Republicans in Michigan that are in the Congress, Dave Camp, who chairs the Ways and Means Committee, Candace Miller, who chairs the House Administration Committee, Mike Rogers, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, and me, who chairs the Energy and Commerce Committee. We have four chairmen, actually, when you count our two senators, six chairmen. No state has that many. And we have enormous responsibilities at the moment that, quite frankly, we would have to walk away from to a pretty large degree, raise money, go every place but home to do that. For me, I've got two kids. I've got a college student still, and he's doing well. And Dave Camp, the same thing. Candace Miller's got grandkids. Mike Rogers has a son. I want to say he's a senior in high school.
And Mike Rogers thought he was going to run, and he said no.
Yeah, and so we were asked early on, and we just said, you know, it really isn't in the cards. I like my job. More importantly, my wife likes me, and we've been able to be pretty successful in election-wise here at home. So it's, you know, if there's any possibility, maybe it's a very slight one, but in essence, we've ruled it out.
Okay, but it doesn't sound like the door is slammed tight
yet.
Yeah,
it's shut. The question is whether it's locked. I've got a number of folks that keep pounding on me, but they know that I'm staying where I am.
You mentioned the enormous responsibility of your committee chairmanship. Under the current House Republican rules, you can serve this term and the next term, correct?
It's like forever. It's an eternity. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
True. It doesn't
seem
like
one of the things that Newt Gingrich did when he became Speaker was first he eliminated the seniority system. Now, that's just for us. It's not necessarily for the Democrats. I would not be chairman today had the seniority system still been in place. And he also imposed term limits. You can get a waiver. Very few waivers have been given. Paul Ryan, I think, may have gotten the first one as chairman of the Budget Committee this time in large part because of his run on the presidential ticket. But he's also in line. You know, Dave Camp's got term limits facing him. He's chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. His 6 years is up at the end of next year. And Paul Ryan, if he decides to stay in the House versus doing something else, is certainly a leading contender to be considered for the chairmanship, assuming that the Republicans keep the House like I think they will. But, yeah, you're right. I have another almost 3 years to go, well, a little bit more than 3.5 years to be chairman.
Okay. Anything else we should know before we wrap it up?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Congressman Fred Upton, thank you for your time.